Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, it might not be too obvious, but good news tonight. Apparently, humans are still evolving. You might recall about 8 years ago, the famous naturalist Sir David Attenborough suggested that perhaps physically and genetically, humans had stopped evolving. And he was citing medical ingenuity, which has abolished some diseases which might have carried people away in earlier times, diabetes, for example, and birth control, amongst other factors, as having perhaps put a halt to natural selection. Not everyone thinks this. Evolutionary biologists believe that Homo sapiens, that's us, are still evolving. So tonight we're going to look at the human body, the past, the present, and perhaps the future capacity for our bodies to adapt and evolve. And would you believe some of the greatest evolutionary secrets are buried in our teeth? Joining us tonight is Professor Tanya Smith, a human evolutionary biologist with Griffith University's Australian Research Centre for Human Evolution and author of the book The Tales Teeth Tell. Tanya, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Well, hello, Philip. Pleasure to be with you.
Yes, no, and looking forward to our chat. Also joining the conversation, Dr. Michelle Langley, who's a lecturer in archaeology and a senior research fellow at Griffith as well in the Centre for Human Evolution. Michelle, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening.
Well, Michelle, one of the focuses of your research has been on Neanderthal behavioural complexity and interaction with modern humans. We've discussed this a bit on the program over the years about the Neanderthals, who will get something of a bad press unreasonably, probably. When we talk about modern humans, we're talking about our species, Homo sapiens, aren't we?
When does that
take us back to?
So dates keep changing as we keep digging up more fossils and archaeological sites. But right now, our anatomical form is about 300,000 years old, whereas our minds, as they are today, are much less, only about 164,000 or thereabouts.
What did you say, our minds?
Our minds. So we know from archaeological evidence that our minds weren't evolving at the same rate of our bodies. So while our anatomical form became very much what it is today around 300,000 years ago, what we would call were then modern Homo sapien, our minds didn't catch up for another 100,000, 150,000 years.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean our brain size?
No, brain size is the same, but it's more we're demonstrating our ability for language, for complex languages, for art, for the complex social interactions which our species is known for.
That's fascinating. So we got smarter all of a sudden, did we? Long after. Maybe let me ask you a different question. Mm-hmm. So today, when we look at modern humans, apart from the fact that we might be taller or something, but we would look mm-hmm. we would look almost identical, would we, to Homo yep. sapiens of 300,000 years ago?
Very similar, yes, very similar.
We're actually a bit smaller in some regards. Folks that lived way back then were quite robust, big faces, thick skulls, sometimes even taller than some of us today, but anatomically similar enough to be part of the same species.
Okay. I mean, Michelle, I'm just interested in this evolution of the mind. Mm-hmm. So what do we believe sparks this? How did this occur?
Well, we're not really sure. There's a big debate about it, and we're not sure if it is one factor over another, but more likely everything together, which is changing climates, increasing population densities in particular, where there's more and more people on the landscape and we're having to negotiate and mediate these social interactions on an increasing scale.
All right. Well, you've looked at the associations with Neanderthals. We know now that they weren't really a different species, were they? Because we share some of their DNA, so there's been some mixing at some point.
They're still classified as a different species, but you're right, there is definitely DNA moving backwards and forwards.
How can they be classified then as a different species if there is obviously been some procreation between those two?
Sure. I can jump in on this one.
Yeah.
There's a couple different species concepts that evolutionary biologists use. One is this idea of reproductive compatibility, that mm-hmm. if you can reproduce and create a viable offspring, then you should be considered the same species. But we know from animal studies that you can have pairings in captivity among very different animals that sometimes do produce viable offspring. Ligers, for example, lions and tigers, and mm-hmm. there's all kinds of, you know, curiosities that we've got documented in the animal world.
I suppose mules is an example too, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, some evolutionary biologists wouldn't take evidence of interbreeding as a reason to consider Neanderthals and humans as the same species. Others would. It's a debate right now. But there are anatomical differences that we can recognize between Neanderthals and modern humans. They're subtle, but they're there. Particularly in the earlier Neanderthals compared to modern humans.
Okay, but the time that Homo sapiens becomes a recognizable species standing on this earth, the Neanderthals are also still there, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Very much so. They're around until at least 40,000 years ago. We're not exactly sure when the last one lived, but probably in the very west of Europe, and possibly down in Spain, and possibly something in the around more like 30,000 years ago.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, to either of you, please jump in on this one. Any of these questions too. Do we think that Neanderthals could speak and were very well, not very much like us, but shared many things with Homo sapiens, don't we? They probably had artistic expression. They certainly had language.
Our understanding of their cognitive and social abilities has changed a lot over the last 20 or 30 years. Not all that long ago, we believed that they weren't capable of language, that they weren't capable of art, that they weren't doing a lot of these really big hallmarks of mm-hmm. what's called modern human behavior, such as complex language, art, ornamenting ourselves with personal adornment like jewelry. But with new excavations, new studies, we're finding that they were capable of language. There's no physical inability that they couldn't produce a language. It might have sounded a bit different to ours, but it was probably there. Considering the complexity of their technology, it certainly suggests that they had to talk to each other to be able to teach their young ones how to make the sophisticated technologies they had. And we also know that they were adorning themselves with ornaments, and the most recent finds have been about eagle feathers and eagle talons.
Mm. So in other words, they weren't that different from us.
No, I think the more that we learn about them, the more we realize they're really not that different from us. And those things that we held back from them originally, we're now finding evidence that they were doing that too.
Mm. It still doesn't help us answer the question as to why they're not with us anymore, does it?
Well, I guess if you consider that, you know, large group of peoples, you know, in Europe and Asia have Neanderthal DNA, they are still with us in some way.
Yeah.
To be fair, the contribution is fairly small. It's not that we're all, those of us of European ancestry, are 50% Neanderthal. That's not, please don't take that away from this conversation. It's a very small percentage of our genome
that
we can see derived, just 1-2%.
So at some point they disappeared, and we're not quite sure why, but presumably it was because they were in competition with Homo sapiens. Or do we think that's the reason, or do we think that perhaps, I don't know, there was a viral pandemic that wiped them out perhaps?
We don't have any concrete evidence about why. There's a lot of different theories. One of them is just that the Neanderthal populations were much smaller than the incoming modern humans moving out of Africa through the Middle East into Europe, and they were just simply overwhelmed. And so occasionally they were maybe integrated, and this is where these small bits of DNA are coming from. But our species is also very violent, and especially where territories and resources are considered. So while we don't have any evidence of interpersonal violence between the species, you can't rule that out either.
Mm. Yeah. We were discussing the other night, Tanya, the oft-quoted observation that we descended from the apes. which mm-hmm. is not strictly true, is it, as such? To step out for us the stepping stones along the way that where humans slowly did evolve from. There was a common ancestor at some point, wasn't there?
There certainly was, yeah. We shared a common ancestor with the chimpanzees somewhere on the order of 6 to 7 million years ago. Mm. They have continued their evolutionary journey over the last 6 to 7 million years. So our ancestor wasn't a chimpanzee per se, but that's certainly our closest living relative today. We share a very large amount of our genetic material that is in common. So we had a common ancestor, say, 6 to 7 million years ago. It was quite different to us today. Small-brained, shorter stature, big canines compared to us today, and not terribly efficient in terms of walking and running. One of the hallmarks of what we think of the human evolutionary story is the transition from a four-footed or a quadrupedal posture and way of going around to a bipedal or a two-footed posture. And that's something we see evidence for about 6 to 7 million years ago in the fossil record.
Hmm. When you look at these numbers, we have been here for the shortest possible time, haven't we?
Mm. Our species is fairly new, yes.
Yeah, I mean, sure. 300,000 years in the in terms of life on this planet is a blink of an eye, isn't it?
It very much so is. And, when we think about the environmental changes that have occurred over that period, it's sort of amazing that we've made it, ice ages and changes in sea level, changes in animal communities and the environments that we evolved in. It's really quite miraculous that there are any hominins left on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Well, that's true. And I mean, it's important to note, isn't it, that the time that Homo sapiens did walk out of Africa, there's not just the Neanderthals around. There are other hominids around too, aren't there?
That
have been popularly termed the hobbits, the Homo floresiensis in Indonesia. There are the Denisovans in China too. Tell me, put them in the picture.
Well, we don't have a lot to say about them in terms of their anatomy because the majority of the evidence is just based on a few teeth and a couple bones, finger bones. So a lot of the evidence that we have for this other line of mm-hmm. human relative really comes from full sequence genomes. And we're able to see that they were closely related to Neanderthals. They shared a common ancestor back, say, 700,000 years ago. They're different from modern humans. So we wouldn't call this Denisovan community Homo sapiens either. We call them a different species. Nobody's named them yet, but they shared many things in common with us. They're also part of the genus Homo. So we could assume they were probably similar sized and, had larger brains and, used to certainly sophisticated technology. Like the Neanderthals did as well.
Hmm. I'm talking with two evolutionary biologists tonight, Professor Tanya Smith, who you just heard speaking from Griffith University, and also Dr. Michelle Langley, who's also at Griffith in the Research Centre for Human Evolution. We're talking about the way the human body has developed in the past, where it possibly might be going to in the future. Tanya, when it comes to the genetic story of fertility and how that's changing intergenerationally. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the story with fertility is an interesting one. In modern times, when we look at generational change in health studies, we can start to see that in communities in the U.S. and in parts of Europe, that women are actually becoming reproductively mature at slightly earlier ages along the generations. And in some instances, the period of fertility is elongating on the other end. So women have the capacity in some populations that have had genetic studies undertaken to actually have children for a longer period of time than their mothers and their grandmothers.
Mm-hmm.
And that in an evolutionary sense makes sense because anything that increases your fitness, your number of offspring will be selected for or elevated. So if women, particularly in communities where we're not modifying our fertility through birth control, women who can have more children and do have more children then have more children that have more children. So we see that as an example of evolution in the formal sense because there's a genetic underpinning for that.
Yeah, exactly. You do a lot of study on teeth. I wanted to talk to you about teeth, Tanya, because you've written a book called The Tales Teeth Tell. about how teeth can help us understand our evolution, our behaviour, our brain development. Talk to me about that. What's preserved in teeth, and how do we date some of that evidence back to our contact with Neanderthals?
Oh, so many different types of evidence can be preserved in teeth. I broke it down in the book, evidence related to our development, evidence related to our evolution, and then to our behavior. Specifically in related to Neanderthals, we can certainly see subtle differences in development because our teeth record the rate of our development.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that Neanderthals grew up a little bit faster. They grew their brains a little bit more quickly than our genus and species, modern humans.
Were their brains as about as big as ours, Michelle?
The same or a little bit bigger.
Okay. Does bigger mean smarter? Not necessarily.
No, not necessarily. We know that their brains are thinking differently to ours because their material culture has quite a different character. So we know their brains are functioning differently, but we don't really know or understand how.
All right. Sorry, Tanya. Back to teeth.
Sure. Well, so in terms of kind of getting at this issue of human evolution in a broad sense, teeth are one of the best types of evidence we have for reconstructing our past history because they're so resilient to destruction. They're almost like fossils in our mouths. So they last longer than just about any other part of our body through the thousands and even millions of years. So a big part of the human story actually comes from the record of teeth that have been left behind for a long time.
What does it tell us about? I mean, we often, you know, talk about the fact that you know, thousands of years ago we were hunter gatherers. We would not eat for sometimes for a day or more while we made our next kill. Is that accurate? I mean, have we always been meat eaters? For example, do we know that?
Well, no, I think in the earlier part of the human journey, before we were the genus Homo, there's a lot of evidence from chemistry and wear patterns that, in fact, there was a stronger plant component to the diet.
Mm-hmm.
The first evidence we have for tool use doesn't come until about 3 million years into the story. And even butchered bones aren't found at many fossil sites until you get into about 2 million years ago. So it's highly likely that meat became more prominent in the later part of this group called Australopithecines, or even an earlier part of our genus Homo. Our brains still weren't the same size as ours today, but we were moving into an elongated or pattern of development and brain increase. So it seems like, having a more diversified diet, having a higher energy diet may have helped move us along the path to what we think of as modern.
Yeah. All right. Michelle, did Neanderthals look, what did they look like?
If you think about a really robust modern human, someone a bit like a rugby player, someone's very musculature, very strong, they were a bit shorter than us, and most of the differences were really in their skull. So in their face, they had bigger noses, they had a lower foreheads, with big, thick brow ridges, and they didn't have a chin. And their skull was more elongated. So while their face kind of comes out from underneath the top of their head, whereas ours is very much pushed back underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So, they would have looked a bit different. You would have recognized that they were a bit different. But exactly how much that would have been, and would you really have recognized that as a different species if you met them, or if it's just a different kind of human, considering how many colors and shapes and forms we come in nowadays?
Sure. Were they hairy?
No, they would have been very similar to what we were around that time period.
Okay. What about Homo sapiens? Are we hairier than we used to be or less?
Tanya?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think body hair varies in terms of when you think of hairiness by geographic region. There's arguments about sweating and the fact that, the way that our body hair is patterned changes the way that we dissipate heat. So if you're, living in a very hot environment, you may have a different patterning of body hair than if you're in a more circumpolar region, for example. So certainly, we're hairier than our ape ancestors in that sense. But, you know, to say we aren't hairy at all is, doesn't do justice to people in parts of the world where sweating isn't so important.
Okay. I mentioned at the beginning in the intro to tonight's program that apparently our grins are shrinking. What does that mean?
Well, that relates to something Michelle talked about with the fact that we have these faces that are actually somewhat tucked under our brains, and they're actually smaller than they used to be in the past. As you can imagine, the cheekbones and the noses of Neanderthals being rather prominent. To some degree, ours were, our cheekbones certainly, and our faces were a bit larger, more robust. And that relates in large part to our diets. We were eating foods that were hunted and gathered. We weren't growing soft cultivars. We weren't microwaving. And so our jaws reflected the use that that we were subjecting them to from early childhood up until the end of life. Whereas today we have such a highly modified diet, and that has been an accumulation from the development of agriculture and then industrial production, that our faces have reduced in size over time, as have our teeth.
Yeah, okay. I understand the dental clues that you've looked at and others have looked at have debunked the paleo diet. I don't want to tip you into a maelstrom of social media here, but is that so? Was there in fact a paleo diet that we could revert to today?
Well, I took issue in my book with the idea of the sort of simplified paleo diet stereotype that, you know, until 10,000 years ago, everybody across the planet was eating lean meat and fresh fruit, and that's the only thing we should do. Yeah. Certainly, eating lean meat and fresh fruit is not a bad thing, but we know that humans lived in a variety of environments and didn't have access to fresh fruit and ate all kinds of different things across the landscape. So the idea that there was just one diet that everybody, you know, evolved to consume 10,000 or 15,000 years ago is really an oversimplification. And that's not just based on evidence we have from chemistry or where tooth wear. It's also based on things like cavities. We see, you know, high starch in some hunter-gatherer communities, which isn't something the paleo diet would encourage. We also see even the mineralized tartar on your teeth, which is calculus, that can trap signatures of your diet, and that can be extracted thousands or even million years ago. And from that, we see that, you know, there was a diversity of things that people were eating in the past. It wasn't just a simple stereotype diet.
Yeah, it's much more diverse than paleo diet would generally have you believe. Yeah.
Okay, so we've always got stuck into most things by the sound of it. Let's take a call or two. Andrew's given us a call. Andrew, g'day, evening.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I've got a question which is probably a bit odd, but it's still on the line of evolutionary biology. There's an interesting theory about people with in regards to colour perception. And there's a theory that in the Roman times, for example, they couldn't actually, they didn't distinguish between, say, red and orange. And I've read some things that talk about the early Egyptians having problems with that in regards to what they were seeing was actually different. Is there any new evidence or anything further that would actually, we know about that as yet?
I could probably start on that one.
Sure.
We have to remember that our understanding of colour is very much culturally driven. So, you know, there's that old adage that people living up in the far north of Canada have, you know, multiple names for different kinds of white and snow because in their landscape they have all those different shades that they recognise. Whereas, you know, if you're living in a very different landscape with very different colours surrounding you, other colours are going to be more important. But all cultures tend to recognise light and dark or white and black first. And then the third colour introduced is always red, which is the colour of our blood and life. And after that, the importance of colours and when they're given names really depends on that culture and what's important to them.
The thing that I was more talking about was, like, for example, obviously the rods and the cones, which actually indicate the colour. I mean, there's scientific evidence. There's women, what they call tetramats, which have actually four different colour perceptors. And what that they're talking about is that, that those colour vision things, there's evidence that seems to be suggesting that colours evolve in regards to how you perceive things and, and what range you can see, etc.
It's an interesting question, I suppose. But is there any is there any way of actually ever knowing?
Well, go, Tanya.
I was just going to say, some of this we actually trace back even much farther in time to our primate ancestors. We have evidence when you look across the order primates, the group that we're part of, that primates that rely on ripe fruit, for example, and the sort of spread of fruit eating in the group of primates, they tend to demonstrate the ability to see more color, more complex color. So this idea of discerning red ripe fruit, or you know, being able to pick out green versus red, it does in part relate to deep time history, not just our recent cultural evolution, but something that goes way back millions and millions of years.
Michelle, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation I found it fascinating that Homo sapiens bodies developed. We're pretty much like. Well, today we're pretty much like we were 300,000 years ago, but our minds are very different. What caused this sudden sophistication? And is it related to brain size? In other words, are our brains continuing to grow?
I think our bodies and our minds are always continuing to grow and change. But when we're talking about, you know, when we first got to the kinds of minds that we are used to now, and the dates on that, it's really looking for the types of archaeological evidence that can give us indications that people were using complex language, or they were using art, or their social systems have become quite complex. So that evidence can be hard to find. And the oldest evidence at the moment is about 164,000 years ago from southern Africa, where they've found evidence for shellfish fishing and use of red pigments. Mm-hmm. And we're interested in red pigments because people will create rock art with them later on, but they also paint their bodies or paint their clothing or their material culture. And when you're decorating yourself, that means you're thinking about identity, whether that be personal identity and group identities. And that means that your concepts around who you are as an individual and who your group is becoming very similar to what we think about today.
Yeah, all right, fascinating. James is on the road. G'day, James.
Yeah, g'day.
Hi.
I have a question relating to teeth again. Many years ago, a friend of mine who happened to be my dentist commented that two of my adult teeth hadn't materialised, and he said that was evidence of evolution. In fact, that even though we're supposed to have, I think, 32 adult teeth, there's a trend for people to have fewer teeth. Can the people comment on that one?
Yeah, interesting, Tanya.
That's correct. And in fact, that's something that we pick up in the last few hundred years. And certainly, you know, again, with this decreasing size of our faces and our jaws, it becomes harder and harder to support a full complement of teeth. They just don't fit right. Mm-hmm. And so one problem some of us have experienced is they get stuck and they never come
out. Oh, is this the whole wisdom teeth problem that modern humans seem to have?
That's right. Yeah, this is a recent problem. It wasn't such a big deal, 300,000 or even, you know.
What, because our jaws have got smaller?
That's right. Our jaws have gotten smaller faster than our teeth have gotten smaller. Our teeth have decreased in size too, as you can imagine. We certainly don't need the, you know, massive chompers since we're, you know, growing wheat and rice and doing things that are much less demanding mechanically. But because there's been a bit of a mismatch, because our jaws have gotten smaller really fast, our teeth get stuck. They don't fit properly together. The incidences of poor fit teeth is something we never saw in the past to the degree we see even in the last few thousand years. So certainly it is an example of evolution. There is a genetic basis for the loss of third molar teeth, and those genes are seemingly becoming more common.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
It is.
Thank you.
It is. Thanks, James. It is fascinating because that's true. That's true. The molar, the wisdom teeth problem is very much a modern human problem, isn't it? I mean, we're forever having complex surgeries to get them taken out.
And to tell you the truth, for people that don't have access to, you know, a clinic, when you have an impacted tooth, that can be fatal. You know, so you don't want those teeth to get stuck for too long, because you can get that, that goes right to the, can go right to the bloodstream and unfortunately be fatal.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Veronica, hello. Hi, Veronica.
Oh, hello there. I've been listening to you for a long time, and the ladies there, good evening.
Mm-hmm.
You constantly say Neanderthal, which is actually incorrect. It's Neanderthal.
Yeah.
And the Thal in German means valley. And the That's people right. of that area, they come from a tributary of the Rhine, which is Neander River. Now, why do you constantly use the foot, which doesn't actually exist in the world?
Veronica, I apologise for this. I
haven't heard you say it at all, or the other ladies either.
Well, I can give you a little context on that, Veronica, because they've modernised the German language, and so the formal. That's not my choice, but the formal name, the Latin name given, it was Thal, but now because of the modernization of German, right, we don't pronounce that. So some of us say Neanderthal and some people say Thal, but it's, you know, we try not to shame each other for using either convention.
Because it also tells you where the group is from.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right.
Because they are from a valley, which is a tributary of the Rhine.
Do we know, actually, that's an interesting question. That's an interesting question, actually. Do we know that that's where they came from, or just that's where they were found?
No,
that was just where
they were first recognized. That wasn't even where they were first found. They were actually first found in Gibraltar.
Mm-hmm.
But they were first published, was an example from the Neander Valley. And that's where their name came from. But the whole population lived not just in that valley or not just in Germany, but the whole of Western Europe into Central Europe down into Israel, butting up against North Africa. So they had a huge territory. And with the name just comes from the first specimen from that particular location that was published in the literature and given the new name.
Hmm.
And I'll give a plug for that. If you have an opportunity to visit Germany, you can go to the Neanderthal Museum and visit that valley, which unfortunately they've quarried out the whole area, but it's worth a visit if you ever are in that part of Germany.
Mm. Mm. Interesting. Thank you, Veronica. Lou says, Phil, colours don't actually exist. We perceive wavelengths of light as colours via our eyes and brains. I presume that's correct in that sense. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Debbie from Petersham says, is it possible that our brain started to grow once we moved to the coast and started to eat fish?
Yes, that is actually some of the idea is that the shellfish in particular, all the nutrients that shellfish holds helped to drive the growth in our brains and the complexity in our brains.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's worth considering, though, it wasn't just that there was only a single step in the change of size of our brains. Yeah. That our brains almost quadrupled since we departed from our shared ancestor with chimpanzees, and that transition has had multiple steps. So maybe that having more energy from having meat in our diet helped to some degree, and then adding other components with fatty acids and omegas, that gave us another bump. But it wasn't just a single step in our evolutionary past.
Yeah, it was a very, very gradual changes. And we tend to often see them in the archaeological record or in our textbooks as these sharp steps up. But it was very much a gradual process.
Mm. I'm talking about the story of the human body tonight with two. Gee, it's a fascinating story, isn't it? With two evolutionary biologists. Professor Tanya Smith is with Griffith University's Australian Research Centre for Human Evolution. And also we're joined by Dr. Michelle Langley, a colleague of Professor Smith's, who's also at Griffith as well, a lecturer in archaeology. Given that, I mean, it's often said that humans are a bit helpless at birth. Why do you think in general, or is there, maybe there's no explanation for this, why have Homo sapiens been so successful?
Given our vulnerability, or
given our general vulnerability, yes.
I would say it's our culture and our technology.
Mm.
So when you first start to learn about archaeology or anthropology, you learn that you're human in the center, like a little bubble, and then outside of that bubble is a bigger one, which we call our culture or technology, and it shields us a lot from things that might otherwise be dangerous or maybe cause us to be more vulnerable. We're able to mitigate risks through our technology that we can use, whether it's just simply having control of fire, and that fire provides us heat in the cold. It provides protection.
How long have we had
predators.
That? How long have we had fire?
Had fire?
Hmm.
Oh, it's a long time. I can't remember the exact date, but it's going to be in the millions, right?
Well, I think some of the evidence is a little bit hard to pin down because it doesn't always preserve in the neatest
way. Well.
So there's some debate about whether it goes back beyond a million years. But certainly Neanderthals were using fire. It
Absolutely.
Was somewhat commonplace in
somewhere
Europe.
Somewhere in Homo erectus. Yeah, so back before.
Okay, so by the time Homo sapiens comes along,
yes.
We're all everyone's using fire.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And by then, with Homo sapiens, we're already, starting to get these other technologies that mitigate more risk, like a spear thrower. The Woomera in Australia, which you use to throw a spear much further and harder than you can just by hand. And the advantage of that technology is that you don't need to get as close to a dangerous animal.
Mm-hmm.
In order to hunt them, because if you miss, you've got an enraged animal who is going to try and stop whoever is hurting it. So you can have those kinds of things, and then we have other technologies like the domestication of the dog, and which may be around 20,000 years ago. Whether they domesticated us or we domesticated them, having a dog around. It's not just added heat in Ice Age, which is always nice, but they protect us. They warn us of strangers approaching or an animal approaching. They can help us hunt. So you could think of them as a type of technology as well.
Mm. All right, 1-300-800-222 is the number if you'd like to call. Sophie in Perth says, that was funny, Sophie, is I was telling my local cafe who was selling paleo pancake mix, that our Stone Age ancestors were unlikely to observe Shrove Tuesday. Yes, well, fair enough. Sophie also says, though, and this is a question I did want to ask you, I wonder whether having individuals survive who a generation or two back wouldn't have is causing our evolution to take a very different path. I mean, plenty of people have observed this over the years, haven't they, that medical interventions, which, for example, prevent people dying of diseases like diabetes, have meant that perhaps that disease is more prevalent now than it was. Therefore, is this longer term going to change the evolution of the body?
Well, it always matters when a disease manifests. So if a disease affects us before we have a chance to leave a descendants, then it's going to hurt in itself in terms of not having a more and more of that particular disease passed down, right? But mm-hmm. if it's a disease that affects us later in life after we've had children, then it won't necessarily be selected against from an evolutionary perspective, meaning, more and more of those genes can become common. I think of eyesight as one of the kind of neatest examples when you think about how many of us have corrected our eyesight either with glasses or laser surgery. And, and there's been some evidence that eye problems are just becoming more and more common, not just because of our technology. Certainly those of us staring at screens aren't helping ourselves, but the selection that would have happened for somebody like me on the savanna, a million years ago with terrible eyesight, I wouldn't have lived long enough to have children. Whereas today, I just correct my eyesight and go on my merry way. Mm. So certain conditions, we are, I think, changing the genetic underpinning of some medical conditions when they aren't changing our survivorship. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. It does. Interesting. Frank, g'day.
Hello.
Hi, Frank.
Yeah. Hi, Philip and ladies. I've always been didn't agree with the out of Africa theory. I'd just like to know what these folks think. Is it ironclad, or is it evolving? I mean, apes are all over the planet. You mentioned the Denisovans in Asia. well, you know, why didn't we just evolve from apes everywhere rather than just all march out of Africa?
Hmm. What's the current thinking on the out of Africa theory? Tanya, so, Michelle?
When you say out of Africa, we're talking about the first underpinnings of the
Of Homo sapiens, yeah.
Yeah, okay. No, I think the evidence is pretty strong still that the fossil record posits, you know, the earliest members of our genus and species in Africa. It's interesting now, though, that there's evidence from different regions within Africa of you know, modern humans that may have kind of created a what we consider today the sort of deepest ancestry. But it's not just one part of Africa. We used to think that it was East Africa that the first Homo sapien came from, but now we've got evidence from North Africa and now evidence from South Africa as well. So it's interesting to think about what was happening with the exchange of cultures and genes, you know, 300,000, 200,000 years ago. But there's really strong evidence, in fact, that that our species did come out of Africa.
That seems to be the view at the moment. That's true. Mm-hmm. David, g'day. Hi, David. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you guys?
Well.
My question is about selection pressures. So my rudimentary understanding of evolution is that we have a selection pressure which selects for a specific trait and that trait becomes dominant.
Mm-hmm.
With modern day society, with disappearance of like selection pressures because we have modern medicine to save people and so forth, why is it that we have traits that are disappearing, like wisdom teeth are no longer used and our jaws are becoming smaller, where there's no specific like sexual desire to choose a mate with like a smaller jaw and so forth?
Yeah, there's different kinds of selection. So we, in classic evolutionary theory, there's something called sexual selection, where it relates to the competition sort of between the sexes. And then there's sort of natural selection, which is a broader level species selection. If it doesn't kill us before we have our children, then it isn't going to change our genetic underpinning, right? That's the key thing. So it's really about things that, like fertility, again, going back to that, that's such an important and strongly selected for trait in humans today, because it directly affects our evolutionary fitness, because it means more fertile women with longer reproductive periods can have more children. And so that raises the number of more fertile women with longer reproductive periods. If it's something like a bad back, you know, poor feet, you know, maybe even bad eyesight, those don't change the frequency of those genes in the gene pool unless they stop us from reproducing.
All right, thank you. Pablo in Yass says, my wife complains about my snoring. I tell her it is an evolutionary matter to let other animals know that our cave is occupied. Yes, I like that. Jim asks a question which I was going to ask too. Why are human babies so helpless for so long? What's the evolutionary benefit of all this? Because after all, human babies, well, forget babies. I mean, small humans are really in no position to protect themselves at all. And for perhaps 8 or 9 years, that's a long time. Is the evolutionary reason that the reason is that is to allow the brain size to develop outside the human body, and that gives us our advantage?
Yeah, it's partly size. It's also energetics that, you know, modern mothers can't provide the energetic meet the energetic needs of a growing infant or embryo or fetus beyond a certain point. So women bear children because they're going to get more energy outside of our bodies than they will continue if they stay in our bodies. So we have such big brains, they demand so much energy that at a certain point we just can't meet that need through our placental nutrition.
Simple.
And then we've got to get them out of our birth canal and live to tell the tale.
That's right.
Okay, so that's right. That's right. So A, we don't have enough capacity to feed them, and B, if we did, they would get so big that we couldn't give birth to them.
Potentially, yeah. Now, one other thing, though, about vulnerability and childhood that's worth thinking about, too, is that by having a long childhood, and this is work I do looking at rates of growth, we have a longer period to learn social behaviors. We have a longer period to develop our brains. Modern humans continue rewiring their brains into their 20s. And so we have this very extended period of flexibility or neuroplasticity where we can really assimilate a lot of this complex culture. And that's something that we think is really more unique to our species. Neanderthals seem to have grown up a bit faster. Probably we would call them adults cognitively at an earlier age from what we know than our species. So there may be a real advantage to staying vulnerable and teachable.
Yeah, that's interesting. What about the idea that humans are becoming less and less physical because they don't need to be, and more cerebral because that these are the skills required? Do you think that's happening? And what difference might that make?
Michelle, do you want to tackle that?
I was just thinking about it. I mean, it probably depends what culture you're in, but even in, you know, if we just think about our own Western cultures, people still love their sport. They still love going to the gym. They're, you know, keeping up their fitness. It's not, you know, chasing after a bison anymore, but there is that fitness is still there. Whereas thinking about things is something that we've done for a very long time. So I'm not sure we've maybe thinking more. It's just maybe we're thinking about different problems.
I think part of the issue isn't just activity, but it's also diet. So the quality of what we eat has gotten in many ways quite poor. And so our bodies aren't, you know, for example, the microbiome in our guts really doesn't like processed food. And so when we think about being sedentary, we sometimes are sedentary because we don't feel very good because we're not eating very well. And so when you think about that, if you went back 1,000 years and we didn't have, you know, industrial sugar production and some of the things that make us actually sick, we might have felt more energetic in a sense and maybe been more active because we weren't processing things that we're not really supposed to be eating.
Evolutionary biologists, Tanya Smith, Professor Tanya Smith, and Dr. Michelle Langley are with us tonight. Steve, hello. G'day, Steve.
Yeah, g'day.
Hi.
Yep. Look, I'm a chef and quite interested in all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was interested to hear the turning point with regards to shellfish in regards to our intelligence.
Yeah.
But a great turning point, which would have to be measured at some point, would be the harnessing of fire in regards to how we processed our foods.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to jump in earlier and point out that cooking is a huge advantage for us.
Why is it a huge advantage?
It makes our food easier to digest. It means that we can take in more calories and more of the goodness from our food than we were able to before we were cooking it. So it provided an advantage to make our bodies and our minds stronger just from being able to cook our meat or prepare tubers or whatever it is that we're eating.
Okay. So this is an answer to all those raw food addicts, Steve.
yeah, absolutely.
Well, no, I shouldn't use the word addict. That's a pejorative term, and I'm not. But the point being that that's right. That, as you would know well, Steve, I presume, cooking not only makes things taste better, they're easier to digest.
Yep, absolutely.
And they take less force to chew, which is again what we start to see in this period where cooking and fire use become more frequent, is also this diminution of parts of our body that just aren't needed in the same way that they once were.
Yeah. I know speculation is useless, but it's also fun. the Israeli writer Noah Yuval Harari has speculated that the way human evolution is going, we are more and more likely to be incorporating machines into our bodies. In fact, he says, if you think about the iPhone, we already have, in a way, because we are so linked with those. What do you think about those ideas, Michelle?
Well, we kind of already do that when we're, you know, replacing valves in our hearts that aren't working. So there's a bit of that going on. And, you know, sci-fi stories have been all over this for decades, that's probably where humans are going. Whether we should or not is something else, or what that might look like. I guess we'll only find out when we get there.
Yes, to Tanya, yes, whether the internet makes us smarter or stupider, I suppose Tanya is actually a moot point, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you what, one of the nice things about having connectivity as a researcher is that we can innovate faster. And so when you think about one of the things that is changing modern medicine is bioengineering. So yes, we may be implanting machines in our bodies, but we're also now actually able to engineer replacement tissues. And so people are working to be able to grow teeth. Imagine that if you had a, instead of having a bridge or a dental implant, you'd be able to regrow a tooth.
That is true. It's fascinating a topic. Look, we have run out of time, but I do thank you for your time. Professor Tanya Smith and Dr. Michelle Langley, both from Griffith University's Research Centre for Human Evolution. Thanks for that. Thanks for your expertise and thanks for the chat.
That was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Good on you. Bye-bye. Thanks for the calls too. Terrific conversations, aren't they?
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.